Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. Today we're going to do part two of my conversation with Steve Greenfield, where he's going to talk about the collapse of the two-party system. So, Steve, do you still want to talk about Republicans, or are we going to touch upon the Democrats?
Well, we're going to do both. I think we should continue with the original plan and start with the Republicans, because they are the ones that are in the middle of a legal process right now. There's just like more visible out there, whereas the Democrats are engaged in this argument kind of in the background among themselves. Although, you know, since the last time we spoke, The Intercept managed to get passed along to them and publish the phone call between Joe Biden and a group of the more prominent centrist type civil rights leaders. And so some of what's going on with them is a little more out in the open, but the Republicans have actually engaged in a legal process. So I think we should address them first and then move to the Democrats from there, just so that we can make a comparison between what's happening between the two groups. And so starting again with the Republicans, despite the fact that the Supreme Court, since we last spoke, has rejected, as I said to you, you know, at the time, there was no possibility that this lawsuit from Texas and the other 16 states was going to be heard, because the question of who gets to determine the voting process and the seating of electors in our federal elections is unambiguously with the states. And that is exactly what the Supreme Court said in their very brief paragraph about declining to take the case, is that they do not have jurisdiction, that Texas does not have standing to bring a case against other states, you know, with their internal processes and bring that to the federal level. And so that played out the way we expected, except there is still one more card to play in this, which is the process in the first week of January, when the newly seated Senate has to vote to accept the vote of the Electoral College. The Electoral College will be meeting and voting tomorrow. But even that's not the end of the process until the first week of January, when the Senate votes to accept the certification of the election. And I suspect that Ted Cruz, when he said that he would argue this case before the Supreme Court if it were accepted by the court, it was pretty much announcing that he would be the one senator that is needed by the Senate process to further delay the certification of the election, even after the Electoral College is finished. So I think we still have one more round of this to observe in the first week of January. Nonetheless, let's get to the implications of it. You know, we framed this last time around, as we have in the past, by trying to remember that we did not actually constitute ourselves as a unified country when we started this country. And it wasn't simply the Constitution, because that was preceded by the Articles of Confederation, and the Articles of Confederation fell apart, you know, and was ended after Shays' Rebellion, because it was unable to manage the country. And they came up with an executive and an executive command of the military as a way of solving that for the future. But we are two separate countries with two separate systems of governance, two separate forms of counting the census when it started, still to this day, two separate forms of casting state votes for the presidency, which is the Electoral College that grants the lower population states significantly additional voting power and creates a minority rule problem, that these were agreed to by one half of the country in exchange for agreeing to join in essentially a free trade and mutual defense alliance with the other country, and likewise back together, that we've been grafted together in this conflicting manner since the birth of the nation. And it's been a matter of trying to manage that conflict ever since. You know, we spent the next 70 years from the adoption of the Constitution constantly adding new compromises in Congress and new compromises to try to extend the tenuous balance between the two sides. The slave side not being willing to ever let the non-slave side gain an electoral advantage over them, the goal being to not be voted out of whatever they felt their interests were as their own part of the country. And then that erupted into the Civil War, and 2.5% of the American population was killed in that process. Right? We've been doing this the whole time, and we're still doing it today. We're still doing it today. We saw in the aftermath of the Supreme Court declining to take the Texas case that Alan West, the head of the Republican Party in Texas, actually released a statement suggesting, once again, as people did in the 1850s through 1860, that without legal redress for what they want, that perhaps the only appropriate solution is for the states that want to live in the particular way that they want to live is to secede and form their own union. He wrote that literally in those words, form a new union with a capital U. Right? You know, and the press gave that the attention that you would expect from somebody using that kind of rhetoric. But it's beyond rhetoric. Okay, many people in this country do not want to live as it was since the beginning under a form of government that tends to seesaw back and forth between one that they see as, you know, serving their interests and one that they see as not. And that's not simply a matter of, you know, right-wing people. Your more liberal, socially liberal corporate-type people feel the same way as well, as we just saw for the last 4 years while Trump was president, and how rebellious everybody felt about things he was doing about immigration, about things that they perceived as racist and homophobic and things like that. So basically, we've been kind of accepting the seesawing back and forth because we believe that we somehow believe in a peaceful transfer of power. But obviously, in the course of our history, we've had many instances of not accepting that, you know, it's not a third world thing. We've done it in America, the most conspicuous case being the Civil War, where we don't accept the peaceful transfer of power. We're seeing a form of that playing out today, wherein half the country has decided that they don't care. They've basically become agents of biological warfare against the other half of the country by refusing to observe protocols about the spread of a disease, as if the disease is somehow imaginary and we are just culturally divided over whether we think we want to wear masks or whether we think we don't, but that the disease itself is not actually real, right? So we've already lost, as of today, it's going to cross the 300,000 mark, right? We actually are engaging in biological civil war internally in this country right now, and we've already tallied 300,000 casualties, and people aren't speaking of it in those terms. They're still speaking of it kind of like as if it's the smart people versus the stupid people, and just continuing to emphasize that it's a cultural problem and that the casualty count is not indicative of something that's more historically consistent in this country between the way that we've been divided since the Mason-Dixon line was drawn and the election system was created. So that's kind of where we are. The Republicans actually filed a form of a legal attempt to do what might in other situations have been done with guns and with weapons, right? Because the idea that you can actually formally secede from America was more or less settled after the Civil War. There was a Supreme Court ruling, I can't remember the name of it, since there is no prohibition against secession in the Constitution itself, but after the Civil War, there was a Supreme Court ruling that still holds that secession is not something people can just vote to do. And so with that in place, what Texas and the other 16 Republican states that joined in this were attempting to do was to literally nullify the election of the people that just happened and turn the selection of the president over to Congress, where they knew that their faction holds the majority, and to, you know, basically, and that is as the closest thing that we can experience to an attempt at a coup, a bloodless coup or a form of secession, to say that the side that lost the vote of the people as counted both in popular votes and in the Electoral College vote, to somehow nullify that and install, by a secluded process, the president of their own choosing. And so whether or not the Supreme Court was ever going to accept the case, that doesn't change the fact that that's the statement they wanted to make. You know, they knew that the Supreme Court wouldn't accept the case, but they did it anyway because they wanted to be on record as saying, this is what we want. This is what we want happening in America. We want our electoral system suspended, you know, and our leadership to be chosen by a small group of people, you know, in a star chamber where they knew that they had a numerical advantage, right? So that this was definitely not so much an attempt to actually overthrow the United States, because like I said, they knew that the court wouldn't hear the case, but they want to be on record as saying that this would be their preference if there were a way to make it happen. And so you've got this split between the Republican Party with a small majority, a little over 60% of Republican states, and the 106 members of Congress represent also about 65% of the Republicans that are in the House of Representatives. So you got close to 2/3 of Republican states and Republican elected officials who just went on record as saying that this is how they want things handled. And so that's the division now in the Republican Party, right? There's a minority faction, previously had been a majority faction, that wanted to just continue the age-old process of, you know, pushing the pendulum back next time. Okay, we lost. We're going to work harder to win next time. You know, kind of like what the Democrats just did right now, right, by really busting their butts to make sure that this time around they'd win the election. You know, and so you've got about 60%, 65% of the former Republican Party structure now at odds. They've become the majority of saying that they don't really care if elections happen or not. You know, so that's the division in the Republican Party, and the advantage in numbers and power and number of states that are governed by Republicans is currently to the side of the people, just like before the Civil War, that don't really care if they get their way by an election, that they'll get their way by any means, and that democracy is unimportant. And so that's kind of a big problem with them right now, that the majority has shifted to disfavoring democracy. And so we're going to have to see how that plays out.
Let me ask you this question, Steve. You just said that the Republicans really don't care about democracy. Do you think this whole thing was fueled by Donald Trump, or do you think this was a notion that they had in their head before Donald Trump?
Well, no, it was obviously it was there. Like I said, it's changed from a minority to a majority. It obviously was there. You know, those kinds of things shift as time goes by. And just as at one time Republicans weren't specifically an anti-abortion party, but, you know, obviously at this point they're overwhelmingly an anti-abortion party, right? I mean, these things do come in different kind of waves and change over time, the Republicans. But, you know, but they make choices, right? The Southern Strategy, after the 1968 election, after George Wallace split from the Democrats and brought five states with him, and the Republicans then capitalized on that by reaching out and inviting all of those people to become Republicans, you know, and obviously the Morrow Majority in 1980, the Tea Party, the Republicans have always reached out to incorporate anti-democratic forces into their coalition so as to keep their numbers up as a way of winning elections. Right. And that's kind of the difference, how things reach tipping points and why you're supposed to observe the progress towards those tipping points while they're happening in case you decide you don't want to reach the tipping point. Right. Since 1969, the Republicans have been pouring enormous amounts of resources into inviting in pools of people that don't believe in democracy. And they were going to ride that tiger, right? They said, okay, well, those people don't believe in democracy, but they still have to vote. They still have to go to the polling places and vote, and they'll vote for us, and we'll win. You know, the people that made these cynical calculations, you know, when Nixon started the Southern Strategy, he wasn't specifically believing that he was taking an act to put his party on the path towards becoming an anti-democracy party. He just was trying to get more votes so that he could win next time. And it's happened in stages, decade by decade, as times marched on. And so now we find ourselves in a place where clearly a significant majority of Republicans no longer care whether they achieve power by democratic means. You know, they'll achieve it by other means, that achieving it by majority vote is not a hard boundary. You know what I mean? Like, we used to think of ourselves as people who had that particular hard boundary. You know, that just wait till next year, you know, like Charlie Brown when your team loses the World Series. All right, just wait till next year. You know, you sucked it up, you took your loss, and you were going to dedicate yourself to doing better next time. And that's what we at least told ourselves and taught ourselves in school, was our national character, that there was an absolute hard boundary on one specific thing, which is that nobody would ever take power without being elected. That once somebody recognized that they had not been elected, they would stand aside and go back into working harder for next time. Obviously, the Republican Party over the course of the 50 years since the Southern Strategy was put into play, have not really been attending to the growth of the anti-democratic tendency, starting to become too significant a proportion of their voting population to potentially be managed indefinitely. And it was the election. Yes, of course, it was the election of Donald Trump that demonstrated that the tipping point had been passed. Actually, the primary victory, before we even got to the general election, the ease with which Donald Trump dispatched the entire establishment field, you know, the total ease without even having to spend much money relative to what they were spending, just by existing, just by tweeting his spite and his anger, right? That he easily dispatched the entire Republican establishment and the majority of the Republicans that were in office once that happened then did the same thing they've been doing for the whole 40 years, which is saying, okay, this happened, but let's manage it. If we just manage it, then gradually we can move beyond it and steer it back. Close the corral door. You know, bring some of those horses in and close the corral door. But obviously, that's not happening, and nobody should have ever expected that would happen, because it's never happened anywhere. So why would it happen here?
We've got 10 minutes to talk about the Democratic Party.
Let's shift to the Democrats. The Democrats engaged in a different kind of approach to the same issue, which is this very powerful division among substantial portions of the population that align themselves with that party. Now, I don't want to create the impression that the Democrats are somehow more devoted to democracy than Republicans, because we've done conversations in the past, including in my own personal situation as a minor party candidate, in seeing that the Democrats in 2020 actually filed a lawsuit in the state of New York to prevent the New York State Board of Elections, which has that constitutional sovereignty over its own internal election processes, to certify candidates for the ballot. So I don't want anyone to think, I want to preface that right up front. I'm not here to exacerbate anybody's belief that like their side is more interested in democracy than the other side. Both are equally interested in themselves winning, and they manage how they attack democracy in different systems. But both of them are attacking democracy. So the Democrats are doing this specifically in an attempt, which obviously doesn't work, to force certain people that are outside their tent into their tent. You know, the Republicans have done it over the last 50 years by invitation, and the Democrats keep doing it by hostage taking. by force. But so they're using different mechanisms to mount the same attitude of disregard for majority democracy as it exists legally in this country. So now they end up, as you see, blue no matter who, right? That's they've created their own slogan to define the rift in their party. They're saying, yeah, we've got a rift, but there's a problem that's bigger than the rift, which is that if we split along the rift, then we don't have enough votes. The Republicans are going to stay unified. They're going to win. And so, this sort of brings us back to things we also have talked about in the past, which is that very few people in the United States anymore consider the problem that they have to be the problems of life. Like, are you employed? How much are you getting paid? Are we at war? Do we have health care? Most of us just now think that the problem is whether the Democrats or the Republicans are going to be in charge. none of us, and that's how we vote. You know, candidates are able to really simplify their speeches now, because all they have to do is say, if you don't vote for me, then the other party is going to end up governing you. And they both say the same thing. And whoever manages to generate the most fear, the most number of people to turn out over the fear of the other possible outcome is going to be the winner. There's barely any ideological or problem solving contribution to how people are making those decisions now. And that's what's making the divisions in the two parties so dangerous at this moment and of such potentially high consequence. The Democrats are now split between people who think basically, and I'll simplify it, between the part that thinks that when a pandemic renders tens of millions of people unemployed and therefore takes away their health insurance that they need in the pandemic, that it doesn't make any sense to have health insurance attached to employment, and that this should be something we treat like the fire department, the police department, public school, a thorny problem that has a solution and you just go ahead and solve it. And the other half that thinks, no, the system that provides maximum profits to private shareholders, is the system that we need to keep going. And everything that's happening in the Democratic Party right now falls along the same line, right? Biden just announced he's nominating Tom Vilsack, a pro, agricultural industry person, to be the Secretary of Agriculture. And, of course, the small farmer people are rebelling against that. They're saying, come on, we just did a blue no matter who and voted for you. And the first thing you're doing is you're putting a Wall Street agriculture secretary back in place. Black people are saying, hey, you're putting the person who fired Shirley Sherrod over a Breitbart complaint right back into that office. The leaked Zoom call that is out on The Intercept, and you can find on YouTube, between six or seven leaders of major centrist, corporatist civil rights groups, in which they were told, you guys are just going to keep on waiting. Biden says, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and you guys are just going to keep on waiting. Similarly, reasserting that you're a hostage, that even if I don't address what you want me to address, you're still stuck with me, And obviously people are getting fed up with that, and so they're having the same battle right now. The conversation during the election among the progressive faction was, we have to do what we have to do. We have to get Trump out of office. And Biden is definitely going to be a better negotiating partner for the things that we believe in than if Trump wins. And so what we need to do is get him elected. And then the next thing we're going to do is start lobbying him and pressuring him to be more progressive and adopt progressive platform items and nominate progressive people to certain key positions. And we're going to hold him accountable. And there's actually a small percentage of the people who said that want to do it. Most of them were just saying it to try to get people to agree and vote with them.
Hallie Hawkins had said that, a lot of people who voted for Biden, wanted Trump out so bad that they didn't care at that point what Biden was saying. So he was not accountable for anything, and now he owes those people nothing. So this is going to be a recipe for disaster.
Oh, yeah, it already is. The disaster is already unfolding because, you know, Biden has told them that he's not going to use, powers as the executive orders for certain things that executive orders actually would cover, that he thinks that restoring the prior systems of executive restraint and using presidential orders to do things is a higher priority than whether the things actually get done. That is literally what he told that group of people on the forum, that he considers restoration of executive order restraint to be more important than fixing the things that have gone wrong, because of Trump being in office. And so this is going to continue raising a sense of rebelliousness amongst the Democrats. They're not as rebellious in as many numbers, and certainly not with the propensity towards violence that we see in the two groups that are splitting the Republican Party. But that split is now there. There are going to be enough people, who want Biden to do what they said and what it seemed he had been agreeing to doing while he was trying to unify the factions for purposes of winning the election, that are going to be out there. So it remains very unknown right now and very precarious. It's bad enough to have the two parties split along that traditional constitutional line of separation that has always held us as two separate countries engaging in free trade since the day the country was founded. But it's all the more dangerous when we see that the two factions themselves have such sharp divisions and such anger towards each other and distrust of each other inside their factions, because that raises the risk that the voting system is going to break down, that candidates are not going to be able to unify their two parties, that there will be more and more people who do not placate themselves with having legitimately lost through the voting system or even legitimately won through the voting system, if the voting system is now decreasingly relevant to the American, psychology, mass psychology. We're really in grave danger right now. We're already engaged in a form of civil war since March, in which the weapon is microbes rather than bullets, and obviously just as deadly as bullets, because 300,000 of us are dead, and 15 right. million of us and 15 million wounded, and economic ruin from coast to coast. As if it were a war with bullets, microbes are a weapon. There is such a thing as germ warfare. We've also been telegraphing to any potential hostile party out there that, they can actually defeat the entire United States with its $20 trillion economy and its massive global military, that if you just send one tourist here that's infected with a deadly disease that could be transmitted through breathing and have that person go buy dinner at a restaurant, they can bring the entire United States to its knees. I don't know if we really wanted to tell the world and the terrorists and any other potential competitors that it really is that easy to take this country down, but that's what we've ended up doing.
Well, Steve, on that note, we've got to close. So you've been listening to part two of Greenfield's analysis, the collapse of the two-party system. Steve, I always enjoy talking with you, and during the next few years, I'm sure we'll have a lot more to talk about. So thanks, Steve, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.
Thank you, everyone. Stay safe.